Tell him he is a natural. Gareth squinted around the smoke that spiralled upwards from the cheroot in the corner of his mouth. Tell him he could go straight in the Salon Privé at Monte Carlo. The Ras grinned and nodded happily at the compliment, and then scowled with concentration as he waited for Gareth to discard. Anyone for the ladies? Gareth asked innocently, as he laid the Queen of Hearts face up on the inverted ammunition box that stood between them. And the Ras squawked with delight and snatched it up. Then he hammered on the box, like an auctioneer, and began laying out his hand. Skunked, by God! Gareth's face crumpled in a convincing display of utter dismay, and the Ras nodded and twinkled and drooled. How do you do? He asked triumphantly. And Gareth judged that the Christmas turkey was now sufficiently fattened and ready for plucking. Ask your venerable grandfather if he'd like a little interest on the next game. I suggest Maria Teresa, a point. And Gareth held up one of the big silver coins between thumb and forefinger to illustrate the suggestion. The Ras's response was positive and gratifying. He summoned one of his bodyguard, who drew a huge purse of lion skin from out of his voluminous chamois and opened it. Hallelujah, breathed Gareth, as he saw the sparkle of golden sovereigns in the recesses of the purse. Your deal, Elsport. The controlled dignity of the Count's bearing was modelled aristocratically on that of the Duce himself. It was the mien of the aristocrat, of the man born to command. His dark eyes flashed with scorn, and his voice rang with a deep beauty that sent shivers up his own spine. A peasant, reared in the gutters of the street. I am amazed that such a person can have reached a rank such as major. A person like yourself. And his right arm shot out with the accusing finger straight as a pistol barrel. A nobody. An upstart. I blame myself that I was soft-hearted enough to place you in a position of trust. Yes, I blame myself. That is the reason I have, until this time, overlooked your impudence, your importunity. But this time you have overreached yourself, Castellani. This time you have refused to obey a direct command from your own colonel in the face of the enemy. This I cannot ignore. The Count paused, and a shadow of regret passed fleetingly behind his eyes. I am a compassionate man, Castellani, but I am also a soldier. I cannot, in deference to this honored uniform that I wear, overlook your conduct. You know the penalty for what you have done, for disobeying your superior officer in the face of the enemy. He paused again, the chin coming up and dark fires burning in his eyes. The penalty, Castellani, is death. And so it must be. You will be an example to my men. This evening, as the sun is about to set, you will be led before the assembled battalion and stripped of your badges of rank, of the beloved insignia of this proud command. And then you would meet your just deserts before the rifles of the firing squad. It was a longish speech, but the Count was a trained baritone, and he ended it dramatically with his arms spread wide. He held the pose after he'd finished and watched himself with gratification in the full-length mirror before which he stood. He was alone in his tent, but he felt as though he faced a wildly applauding audience. Abruptly, he turned from the mirror, strode to the entrance of the tent, and threw back the flap. The sentries sprang to attention, and the Count barked, "Have Major Castellani summoned here immediately!" "Immediately, my Colonel," snapped the sentry, and the Count let the flap drop back into place. Castellani came within 10 minutes and saluted smartly from the entrance of the tent. "You sent for me, my Colonel?" "My dear Castellani." The Count rose from his desk. The strong white teeth contrasted against the dark olive gold tan as he smiled with all his charm and went to take the Major's arm. "A glass of wine, my dear fellow." Aldo Belli was enough of a realist to see that without Castellani's professional eye and arm guiding the battalion, it would collapse like an unsuccessful souffle, or more probably like a dynamited cliff upon his head. Passing sentence of death on the man had relieved the Count's feelings, and now he could feel quite favourably disposed towards him. "Be seated," he said, indicating the camp chair opposite his desk. "There are cigars in the humidor." He beamed fondly, like a father at his eldest son. "I would like you to read through this report, and to place your signature in the space I have marked." Castellani took the sheaf of papers and began to read, frowning like a bulldog, and with his lips forming the words silently. After a few minutes, he looked startled and glanced up at Aldo Belli. "My colonel, I doubt if it was 40,000 savages that attacked us." "A matter of opinion, Castellani, it was dark. No one will ever know for certain how many there were." The Count waved the objection aside with a genial smile. "It is merely an informed estimate. Read on. You will find I have good things to say of your conduct." And the Major read on and blanched. "Colonel, the enemy casualties were 126 dead, not 12,600. "Ah, a slip of the pen, Major. I will correct that before sending it to headquarters." "Sir, you make no mention of the enemy possessing an armoured vehicle." And the Count frowned for the first time since the beginning of the meeting. "Armoured vehicle, Castellani? Surely you mean an ambulance?" The encounter with the strange machine was best forgotten, Belli had decided. It reflected no credit on anybody, particularly none upon himself. It would merely add a jarring note to the splendours of his report. "It would be quite in the normal course of things for the enemy to have some sort of medical service. Not worth mentioning. Read on, caro mio. You will find that I have recommended you for a decoration." General de Bono had summoned his staff to a lunchtime conference to appraise the readiness of the expeditionary force to commence its invasion of the Ethiopian highlands. These conferences were a weekly affair, and the general's staff had not taken long to understand that in exchange for a really superb luncheon, for the reputation of the general's chef was international, they were expected to provide the general with good reasons which he might relay to the Duce for delaying the start of the offensive. The staff had fully entered into the spirit of the game, and some of their offerings had been inspired. However, even their fertile imaginations were now beginning to plough barren land. The Inspector General of the Medical Corps had tentatively diagnosed a straightforward case of gonorrhea, contracted by his infantryman as suspected smallpox, and had written a very good scare story, warning of a possible epidemic. But the general was not certain whether it could be used or not. They needed something better than that. They were discussing this, now over the cigars and liqueurs, when the door of the dining room was thrown open and Captain Crispy hurried to the head of the table. His face was flushed and his eyes wild, his manner so agitated that an electric silence fell over the room full of very senior and highly inebriated officers. Crespi handed a message to the general, and he was so disturbed that what was intended as a whisper came out as a strangled cry of outrage. "The clown!" he panted. The clown has done it!" The general, alarmed by this enigmatic statement, snatched the message, and his eyes flew across the sheet before he handed it to the officer beside him and covered his face with both hands. "The idiot!" he wailed, while the message passed swiftly from hand to hand, and a hubbub of raised voices followed it. "At least, Your Excellency, it is a great victory," called an infantry commander, and suddenly the entire mood of the assembly changed. "My planes are ready, General. We await the word to follow up this masterly strategy of yours," cried the commander of the Regia Aeronautica, leaping to his feet, and the general uncovered his eyes and looked confused. "Congratulations, my general," called an artilleryman, and struggled unsteadily upright, spilling port down the front of his jacket. "A mighty victory!"
"Oh, dear," murmured de Bono. "Oh, dear."
An unprovoked attack by a horde of savages. Crespi had retrieved the message and read the memorable words of Count Aldo Belli aloud. Firmly resisted by the courage of the flower of Italian manhood.
Oh, dear,
said De Bono, a little louder, and covered his eyes again. Almost 15,000 of the enemy dead, shouted a voice. An army of 60,000, routed by a handful of fascist sons, it is a sign for the future. Forward to the ultimate victory! We march! We march! And the general looked up again.
Yes, he agreed miserably. I suppose we shall have to now.
The 3rd Battalion of the Black Shirt Africa Regiment was paraded in full review order on the sandy plain above the wells of Chaldee. The ground was neatly demarcated by the meticulous rows of pale canvas tents and neat lines of white stone. In 24 hours, under the goading of Major Castellani, the camp had taken on an air of permanence. If they gave him a day or two more, there would be roads and buildings also. Count Aldo Belli stood in the back of the rolls, which, despite the loving attentions of Giuseppe the driver, were showing signs of wear and attrition. However, Giuseppe had parked it with the damaged side away from the parade, and he had burnished the good side with a mixture of beeswax and methylated spirits until it shone in the sunlight, and had replaced the shattered windscreen and the broken lamp glass. I have here a message received an hour ago, which I shall read to you, shouted the Count, and the parade stirred with interest. The message is personal to me, from Benito Mussolini.
Il Duce! Il Duce! Il Duce!
Roared the battalion in unison, like a well-trained orchestra. And the Count lifted a hand to restrain them, and he began to read. My heart swells with pride when I contemplate the feat of arms undertaken by the gallant sons of Italy, children of the fascist revolution whom you command. The Count's voice choked a little. When the speech ended, his men cheered him wildly, throwing their helmets in the air. The Count climbed down from the rolls and went amongst them, weeping, embracing a man here, kissing another there, shaking hands left and right, and then clasping his own hands above his head like a successful prize fighter, and crying, Ours is the victory, and death before dishonour, until his voice was hoarse and he was led away to his tent by two of his officers. However, a glass of grappa helped him to recover his composure, and he was able to pour a warrior's scorn on the radio message from General De Bono, which accompanied the paean of praise from Il Duce. De Bono was alarmed and deeply chagrined to discover that the officer he had judged to be an ineffectual blowhard had indeed turned out to be a firebrand. In view of the Duce's personal message to Belli, he could not, without condemning himself to the political wilderness, order the man back to headquarters, and under his protective wing, where he could be restrained from any further flamboyant action. The man had virtually established himself as an independent command. Mussolini had chided De Bono with his failure to go on the offensive, and had held up the good Count's action as an example of duty and dedication. He had directly ordered De Bono to support the Count's drive on the Sardi Gorge and to reinforce him as necessary. De Bono's response had been to send the Count a long radiogram, urging him to the utmost caution and pleading with him to advance only after reconnaissance in depth and after having secured both flanks and rear. Had he delivered this advice 48 hours earlier, it would have been most enthusiastically received by Aldo Belli, but now, since the victory at the Wells of Chaldee and the Duce's congratulatory message, the Count was a changed man. He had tasted the sweets of battle honours and learned how easily they could be won. He knew now that he was opposed by a tribe of primitive black men in long nightdresses armed with museum weapons who ran and fell with gratifying expedition when his men opened fire. Gentlemen, he addressed his officers, I have today received a code green message from General De Bono. The armies of Italy are on the march. At 1200 hours today, he glanced at his wristwatch, in just 12 minutes' time, the forward elements of the army will cross the Mareb River and begin the march on the savage capital of Addis Ababa. We stand now at the leading edge of the sword of history. The fields of glory are ripening on the mountains ahead of us, and I, for one, intend that the 3rd Battalion shall be there when the harvest is gathered in. His officers made polite, if uncommitted, sounds. They were beginning to be alarmed by this change in their colonel. It was to be hoped that this was rhetoric rather than real intention. Our esteemed commander has urged me to exercise the utmost caution in my advance on the Sardi Gorge. And they smiled and nodded vehemently. But the Count scowled dramatically and his voice rang. I will not sit here acquiescent while glory passes me by. A shudder of unease ran through the assembled officers, like the forest shaken by the first winds of winter, and they joined in only half-heartedly when the Count began to sing La Giovinezza. Lige Mikhail had agreed that one of the cars might be used to carry Sara up the gorge to the town of Sardi, where a Catholic mission station was run by an elderly German doctor. The bullet wound in the girl's leg was not healing cleanly, and the heat and swelling of the flesh and the watery yellow discharge from the wound were causing Vicky the greatest concern. Fuel for the cars had come down from Addis Ababa on the narrow gauge railway as far as Sardi, and had then been packed down the steeper lower section of the gorge by mule and camel. It waited for them now at the foot of the gorge, where the Sardi River debouched through a forest of acacia trees into a triangular valley, which in turn widened to a mouth 15 miles across before giving way to the open desert. At the head of the valley, the river sank into the dry earth and began its long subterranean journey to where it emerged at last, in the scattered waterholes at the wells of Chaldi. Lige Mikhail was going up to Sardi with Vicky's car, for he'd arranged to meet the Ras of the Galas there in an attempt to coordinate the efforts of the two tribes against the Italian aggressors. And then an aircraft was being sent down to Sardi from Addis to fly him to an urgent war conference with the Emperor at Lake Tana. Before he left, he spoke privately with Jake and Gareth. Walking with them a short way along the rugged road that climbed steeply up the gorge, following the rocky watercourse of the Sardi River. Now they stood together, staring up the track to where it turned into the first steep bend, and the river came crashing down beside it in a tall white-plumed waterfall that drifted mist across the surface of the track and induced a growth of dark green moss upon the boulders.
"It's as rough as a crocodile's back here," said Jake. "Will Vicky get the car up?"
"I have had 1,000 men at work upon it, ever since I knew you were bringing these vehicles," the Lige told him. "It is rough, yes, but I think it would be possible."
"I should jolly well hope so," Gareth murmured. "It's the only way out of this lovely little trap into which we've backed ourselves. Once the Itais closed the entrance to the valley..." And he turned and swept a hand across the vista of plain and mountains that lay spread below them, and then he smiled at the prince. "Just the three of us here now, Toffee, old boy. Let's hear from you. What exactly do you want from us? What are the objectives you've set for us? Are we expected to defeat the whole bloody army of Italy before you pay us out?"
"No, Major Swales." The prince shook his head. "I thought I had made myself clear. We are here to cover the rear and flank of the Emperor's army. We must expect that. Eventually, the Italians will force their way up this gorge and reach the plateau and the road to Desi and Addis. We can't stop them, but we must delay them at least until the main engagements in the north are decided. If the Emperor succeeds, the Italians will withdraw here. If he fails, then our task is over." "How long until the Emperor fights?"
"Who can tell?"
And Jake shook his head, while Gareth took the stub of his cigar from his mouth and inspected the tip ruefully.
I'm beginning to think we're being underpaid, he said. But the prince seemed not to hear, and he went on speaking quietly, but with a force that commanded their attention. We will use the cars here, on the open ground in front of the gorge, to the best possible effect, and my father's troops will support you. He paused, and they all looked down at the sprawling encampment of the Rasi's army, amongst the acacia trees. Stragglers were drifting in across the plain from the route at the wells, lines of camels and knots of horsemen, surrounded by amorphous formations of foot soldiers. If the Gallus join us, they can provide another 5,000 fighting men. That will bring our strength to 12,000, or thereabouts. I have had my scouts study the Italian encampment, and they report an effective strength of under 1,000, even with their armaments, so we should hold them there for many days. Unless they're reinforced, which they will be, or bring up armour, which they will do, said Gareth. Then we will withdraw into the gorge, demolishing the road as we go, and resisting at each strong place. We won't be able to use the cars again until we reach Sardi. But there, in the bowl of the mountains, there is good open ground and room to manoeuvre. It is also the last point at which we can effectively block the Italian advance. They were silent again, and the sound of an engine came up to them. They watched the armoured car reach the foot of the gorge and begin growling and nosing its way upwards, at the pace of a walking man. Except where it had to back and lock hard to make one of the steep hairpin bends in the road. The Lidge roused himself and sighed with what seemed a deep weariness of the spirit. One thing I must mention to you, gentlemen. My father is a warrior in the old style. He does not know the meaning of fear, and he cannot imagine the effect of modern weapons, especially the machine gun, on massed foot soldiers. I trust you to restrain his exuberance. Jake remembered the bodies, hanging like dirty laundry on the barbed wire of France, and felt the cold trickle run up his spine. Nobody spoke again until the car, still blazoned with its crimson crosses, drew up level with where they stood, and they scrambled down the bank to meet it. Vicky's head appeared in the hatch. She must have found an opportunity to bathe, for her hair was newly washed and shiny, and caught behind her head in a silk ribbon. The sun had bleached her hair to a whiter gold, but the peachy velvet of her complexion had been gilded by the same sun to a darker honey colour. Immediately, Jake and Gareth moved forward, neither trusting the other to be alone with her for an instant. But she was brusque, and concerned only with the injured girl who was laid out on the floor of the cab on a hastily improvised bed of blankets and skins. Her leave-taking was offhand and distracted, while the Lidge climbed in through the rear doors, and she pulled away again up the steep track, followed by a squadron of the prince's bodyguard, looking like a gang of cutthroats on their shaggy mountain ponies, festooned with bandoliers of ammunition and hung with rifles and swords. They clattered away after the car, and Jake watched them out of sight. He felt a sense of deep unease that the girl should be up there in the mountains beyond any help that he could give her. He was staring after the car. "Put your mind back in your pants," Gareth advised him cynically. "You're going to need it for the eye ties now." From the foot of the gorge to the lip of the bowl of land in which stood the town of Sardi was a few dozen miles across the ground, but the track climbed 5,000 feet, and it took 6 hours of hard driving for Vicky to reach it. The prince's labour gangs were working upon the track still, groups of dark men in mud-stained chamois, hacking away at the steep banks and piles of boulders that blocked the narrow places. Twice these men had to rope up the car to drag and shove it over a particularly treacherous stretch, with the torrent roaring in its bed 100 feet below, and the wheels of the car inches from the crumbling edge of the precipice. In the middle of the afternoon, the sun passed behind the towering ramparts of stone, leaving the gut of the gorge in deep shadow, and a clammy chill made Vicky shiver even as she wrestled with the controls of the heavy vehicle. The engine was running very unevenly and backfiring explosively at the change of atmospheric pressure as they toiled upwards. Also, Sarah's condition seemed to be worsening rapidly. When Vicky stopped briefly to rest her aching arms and back muscles, she found that Sarah was running a raging fever. Her skin was dry and baking hot, and her dark eyes were glittering strangely. She cut short her rest and took the wheel again. The gorge narrowed dramatically, so the sky was a narrow ribbon of blue, high above, and the cliffs seemed almost to close jaws of granite upon the labouring car. Although it seemed impossible, the track turned even more steeply upwards, so that the big back wheels spun and skidded, throwing out fist-sized stones like cannonballs and scattering the escort who followed closely. Then, abruptly, Vicky drove the car over the crest and came out through rocky portals into a wide, gently inclined bowl of open ground, hemmed in completely by the mountain walls. Perhaps 20 miles across, the bowl was cultivated in patches and scattered with groups of the round tukuls, the thatch and daub huts of the peasant farmers. Domestic animals, goats and a few cows, grazed along the course of the Sardi River, where the grass was green and lush and thick. Forests of cedar trees found a precarious purchase along the rocky banks. The town itself was a gathering of brick-built and white-plastered buildings, whose roofs of galvanized corrugated iron caught the last probing rays of the sun as it came through the western pass. Here, in the west, the mountains fell back, allowing a broad, gentle incline to rise the last 2,000 feet to the level of the plateau of the highlands. Down this slope, the narrow-gauge railway looped in a tight series of hairpins until it entered the town and ended in a huddle of sheds and stock pens. The Catholic mission station was situated beyond the town, on the slopes of the western rise. It was a sadly dilapidated cluster of tin-roofed daub buildings grouped around a church built of the same materials. The church was the only building that was freshly whitewashed. As they drove past the open doors, Vicky saw the rows of rickety pews were empty, but that lighted candles burned upon the altar, and there were fresh flowers in the vases. The church's emptiness and the sorry state of the buildings were a reflection of the massive power of the Coptic Church over this land and its people. There was very little encouragement given to the missionaries of any other faith, but this did not prevent the local inhabitants from taking advantage of the medical facilities offered by the mission. Almost 50 patients squatted along the length of the veranda that ran the full length of the clinic, and they looked up, with minimal interest, as Vicky parked the armoured car below them. The doctor was a heavily built man, with short, bowed legs and a thick neck. His hair was cropped close to the round skull and was silvery white, and his eyes were a pale blue. He spoke no English, and he acknowledged Vicky with a glance and a grunt, transferring all his attention to Sarah. When two of his assistants rolled her carefully onto a stretcher and carried her up onto the veranda, Vicky would have followed, but the lidge restrained her. "She's in the best hands. And we will have work to do." The telegraph office at the railway station was closed and locked, but in answer to the prince's shouts, the station master came hurrying anxiously down the track. He recognized Lidge Mikhail immediately. The process of tapping out Vicky's dispatch on the telegraph was a long, laborious business, almost beyond the ability of the station master, whose previous transmissions had seldom exceeded 12 words at a time. He frowned and muttered to himself as he worked, and Vicky wondered in what mangled state her masterpiece of the journalistic art would reach her editor's desk in New York. The prince had left her and gone off with his escort to the official government residence on the outskirts of the village, and it was after 9 o'clock before the station master had sent the last of Vicky's dispatch, a total of almost 5,000 words. And Vicky found that her legs were unsteady and her brain woolly with fatigue when she went out into the utter darkness of the mountain night. There were no stars, for the night mists had filled the basin and swirled in the headlights as Vicky groped her way through the village and at last found the government residence.